Hello, you're listening to On the Point, the News Collective's show formerly known as Democracy Watch, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Isaac Yu.
I'm Joshua Azizi.
I'm Akshay Kulkarni.
I'm Maddie Zelplane.
And I'm Alex Trabulsi. It's Friday, October 30th. We're broadcasting remotely nowadays, but we're based on UBC's Vancouver campus, on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
We've got a packed show for you today. Up first, we've got an interview with Fiona York, an administrator and coordinator from the Carnegie Community Action Project in the downtown east side. Fiona does peer support and outreach work in the Tent City in Strathcona Park, and she's speaking with us today to give us a glimpse into what the life is like inside the park.
We'll also be talking with Greg Mansfield, the author of Ghosts in Vancouver. He's here with us today to talk about which notable locations in Vancouver are haunted ahead of Halloween tomorrow.
On the topic of Halloween, we'll also be discussing the City of Vancouver's fireworks ban that goes into effect after tomorrow, and the scariest thing that's happened to BC in the last week, the provincial election. But first, Maddie, could you tell us a bit about why you wanted to chat with Fiona York about the Tent City in Strathcona?
Sure, actually. Strathcona Park has been in the news a lot over the last month, and it's become the focal point for a fair amount of tension between those living in the tents and some of the housed residents in the neighborhood. A lot of this coverage is also focused mainly on recent violent incidents. But as we saw with Oppenheimer and Crab Park, there are a lot of factors at play here, and there's a lot of stigma around poverty and substance use that tends to take over the discussion when talking about tent cities. I thought that a conversation with Fiona would shine some light on what it's been like for folks living and working in the park. I wanted to see what some of the campers' concerns were, as well as follow up on some recent City Hall decisions that could impact this community. So Fiona and I chatted about the overnight parking ban, as well as the new housing proposals and what this might mean for people on the ground. Let's listen to the interview. And I guess just to start, would you mind just telling our listeners what your name is, what you do, and what your connection to the Tent City at Strathcona Park is?
Sure. So my name is Fiona York, and I've been involved with the Tent Cities since fall of 2018, and it began with my role as coordinator and administrator of the Carnegie Community Action Project. So I was supporting the Tent City at Oppenheimer Park, and it just started with kind of advocating and lobbying for people staying at the park, counting on the numbers, checking on people, providing some direct supports and doing some kind of media and publicity around what was happening in order to support advocacy efforts. And then from there, supporting Oppenheimer for over a year, and then Crab Park, and now Strathcona Park. And my role now is more as a volunteer, and I do everything from frontline direct supports, working directly with residents, to the advocacy side and the political side, and meeting with various stakeholders like the residents. There's residents meetings and organizing within the camp, and then like park staff and city staff, and kind of on that level as well.
What would you say, I guess, if you had to highlight some of like the biggest concerns right now facing Tent City residents at Strathcona Park?
I would say right now the cold is a really big concern, and food security, those are probably two big ongoing ones. We've also, and maybe peer support. So we've now accessed some funding that is for peers to have different roles within the camp. And we've always had that to some degree, but we're sort of accessing and coordinating a little bit more of that now. So we have peers that do cooking and support with food, purchasing food supplies and preparing meals. We have volunteers who are doing security and safety patrols and cleanup and helping with fire keeping and different roles within the camp. And so we've, as I said, we've accessed some funding for that, but it is just an ongoing area of support, and having those roles done by peers, residents in the camp makes a really big difference. So, you know, having people empowered, and also just the level of respect that's given to one another when it's residents who are within those roles. And then also just providing that kind of support for people to take on those positions and have those, the stipends, is really important and makes a big difference just in the infrastructure and running of the camp. The cold and the hypothermia is an ongoing worry. One of our next projects will be working on a warming tent or a warming center. There are a few beds that open when it's really, really cold and the temperature is below zero for the extreme weather centers, but they're quite far and there's very few beds. They fill up very quickly. And with the extreme weather shelters, they're not necessarily places that you could sleep. They're places where you're just maybe sitting in a warm place overnight. So it's not really meeting the needs of 500 people, up to 500 people who are really cold and just can't access those facilities. So I think those would be the immediate needs areas right now.
The city had announced fairly recently that it was going to roll out like a new affordable and supportive housing plan and hopefully get some of the residents in Strathcona Park housed. Do you have any idea on like when we can expect to see housing offered to people who are currently living at the tent city?
The latest I'm seeing, and I'm probably just, you know, reading this report and so not getting this firsthand, but the latest I'm seeing is that it might be, I think, December, like winter, almost winter before this happens. I've been checking in with the various people who are like the outreach workers who would have access to that information, and I haven't got any definitive answers, but it sounds like it will still take 4 to 8 weeks, I think, to have that put together. The way that was proposed by the city, there are many issues with that. The first sort of the obvious one being that all of what's being offered is temporary. It's really too little, too late in lots of ways. And it's kind of more of the same. So it's perpetuating a lot of the cycles that we've seen that have produced the current conditions and the homelessness crisis. Also, as part of what the city proposed, there was the addition, which is of shelters, which is really a huge trigger for a lot of people. And just the idea that kind of out of sight, out of mind, getting people into shelters, and then the problem is just kind of overlooked and there's no longer that push for the permanent housing that's required. And for so many people, the shelters are just a major trigger. They're, you know, not something that's conducive in a lot of ways for people going indoors. And many of the things that are being offered, like SROs, are just sort of more of that cycle of the same things that are not things that necessarily work for people. Of course, for some people, the hotels and what's being offered was very welcome, just so people can get indoors and be warm. And we definitely support and encourage people to access any supports that are being offered that work for them. But it's just disappointing to see the same sort of cycle of so little being offered and the offer of shelters and SROs where we already know that doesn't work for so many people and it's not a solution. And it's just a way to kind of really target people and staying in the park under pressure from external, those external pressures of like neighborhood and not really consulting with people about what would work best for them.
Yeah, and I guess along those lines, could you expand a bit on what would you would hope the city would consider when it comes to like housing plans and housing initiatives like this moving forward?
I'd say first, what we were asking for was consultation, like a really true consultation, like focus groups or more thorough consultation with people staying in the park and others. And then another thing is just that rather than targeting the people staying in the park, which is the way that it very obviously ended up, and repeating what was done at Oppenheimer, where the housing is offered first to those who are the most obvious people because they're visible by staying in a tent city, which makes them safer, that the housing or whatever is being offered and those supports be offered to everybody who's homeless, which is a much more vast number, and people who are, we know, are in higher need. You can walk down Hastings Street at any time and see the numbers of people who are on the street and in tents on the street that are getting moved along all the time, having all their belongings thrown away, that are extremely vulnerable and isolated. And then there's those, we learned when the park board was going through their bylaw hearings that there's something like 260 parks in Vancouver and about 117 of those have people camping in them at all times. So people are camping in parks and staying in parks all over. And those are people where it's just a small number and they're more isolated, they're more alone, they're maybe more vulnerable, there might be less you know, observation of their needs and their level of vulnerability. So the housing should be offered to everybody and to those who are most vulnerable first, even if that means going to seniors and people with chronic health conditions and underlying health conditions that make them more susceptible to the pandemic. So getting those people housed first rather than just targeting people staying in the park, which is clearly what happened both with Oppenheimer and then with this current motion from the mayor. So the consultation, housing for everybody, and then really working towards permanent housing rather than more of the SROs and the supportive housing where people have already expressed that it doesn't work for them in lots of ways. Is it something that actually is tenable and safe and sustainable for people? And where is the movement towards permanent housing?
Sort of shifting gears a little bit, I just wanted to see, and earlier this month, the city had announced that it would be enforcing the ban on like overnight parking near Strathcona Park. And I know that a lot of people kind of saw that as like a targeted attack on people who are living out of their vehicles. Have you noticed any changes like since the announcement was made, and like what has the impact been on the community since it was enforced, if any?
I'd say in terms of the impact, with all of these things that have been happening, there's a lot of anxiety right now within the park and a lot of tension. People aren't really sure what's happening. There's a lot of questions. Are we going to be evicted? Is, you know, something going to happen to us? Are we going to get moved? Are we going to get housing? So just overall, there's like a really high degree of anxiety and tension. So that I think is further perpetuated with this move about with the overnight parking ban as well. So we have not, we've been monitoring, we have not yet seen signs going up, but we're being told that they will be going up. There was, I believe, some officials that were starting to talk to people staying in RVs about this move and then what would happen and what they would require. There's talk about connecting people to housing outreach supports, but we know there's no housing. And so, you know, connecting people to housing workers is not, just not the same as offering housing. And it just contributes to the crisis of homelessness. And the city, I did ask a lot of questions and followed up on this, and they said that this is something that's being done in other locations like Jericho Beach and Spanish Banks and other places where I guess people have been parking, and so they were just kind of cycling, and this is now, the park is now something on their radar. They had wanted to do it before, but then the pandemic started and so they put it off, and now this is the timing. I don't find any of those answers really, you know, suitable. It doesn't really address the issue. It's still not an appropriate time. If any, the city itself in their proposal recently, they actually talked about RV parks and people staying in RVs, and now they're actually making it impossible for people to do that and creating more homelessness. So it basically does contribute just to that overall tension and anxiety. Where are people going to go? What's going to happen? Are they going to be forced out and evicted? It just further creates more homelessness, definitely takes away another option that people have. And it's just being done really like not a lot of integrity in terms of the timing and the way that it's coming about. Again, we haven't seen any like really specific action yet, but we know, we've been told that it's coming. So we're watching for that.
I mean, since this has been sort of such a major feature of a lot of coverage lately, there have obviously been like a lot of complaints from some of the housed residents in the area regarding the tent city. And like, there's been some coverage of like recent reports of violence and things like that. What are your thoughts regarding these concerns?
There's some different things that are happening. There are concerns that are coming from neighbors. And while we're, you know, really compassionate and feel that everybody should feel safe, I think there's also a really massive amount of scrutiny that's happening on the park right now. And so there are some things that I'm not talking about every instance or every incident, but some things where it's really kind of disproportionate to what's happening, and things are really being, the concerns are really being targeted towards the park. And there's this like really major kind of surveillance and concern and a connection to everything, to making everything about the park. For example, there was the incident with our city councilor, Pete Fry, and somebody who was in the neighborhood. And that was a really widespread issue in the media. And there was a video of an incident with himself and a neighbor and a gentleman who was on somebody's lawn using substances. And, you know, we kind of knew and discovered afterwards from talking to the gentleman that was in the video that this is somebody who'd been in the neighborhood for a long, long time. The neighbors actually knew the person. He'd been around for years and years before the tent city was there. And so there's a number of things happening. So obviously it's sort of just that ongoing kind of stigmatization of people in poverty and drug use and substance use, but also it's just this really hypersensitivity and scrutiny on the park. But it's also, on top of that, it's increasing this sort of vigilantism and mentality around the park and creating further stigmatization and division that's really kind of out of proportion. From after that incident, we did see ongoing kind of vigilantism and that kind of mentality from neighbors where people were being harassed in McLean Park, for example. And there was sort of the ongoing targeting that if anything happens, it's to do with the tent city, where we know these things happen all over the place. We know things happen behind closed doors and behind walls and in houses and in other neighborhoods in the West End. Things happen everywhere. And it's just that right now there's a really hyper scrutiny and it's getting a lot of attention. And, you know, I'm sure it's true that it's easier to listen to people who are paying taxes and have houses than it might be to hear the voices of people who are really marginalized and stigmatized about, you know, what's happening, and just kind of hearing those other voices and perspectives. Certainly there have been some incidents that are really difficult and really troubling. And we, as I mentioned earlier, there is a residence patrol and security patrol. And again, we know these incidents happen all over the city, all over the downtown east side, all over so many communities. And we want to look out for our own and do our best to support people who've been impacted and families and, you know, just really troubled and saddened by any incidents that have happened in our community. And it's a community we want to keep safe along with everybody else. And, but also not to further that really harmful stigma and vigilantism that can happen and can flow from this, because that just makes things so much worse.
Yeah, absolutely. And I recognize that this is probably kind of a big question to ask, but is there anything, like, what would you feel would be the most effective in terms of trying to add a sense of security, both for like the housed residents of Strathcona and the tent city residents?
We really feel strongly about peer support and working with peers within the camp. And we've been asking, again, you know, many of our resources come from our community and people, individual support and donations, but we've been asking for, you know, different levels of government to support more peer programming and peer support so that we could put together things like safety patrols and community patrols and block watch programs. So finally now that's starting to happen. And so we've got some support for that. And really it's the most effective way to keep people safe, because there's that kind of innate respect for peers and it's much more effective and there's more kind of community knowledge and community support for that. Just not having that stigma, having sort of open flows of communication, being able to talk to our neighbors and talk to one another, sort of doing our best to always keep that communication open. We used to have regular meetings, and we have regular meetings with different stakeholders once a week. So keeping those lines of communication open, but working with our community and our peers and accessing support for that.
And I guess just as far as sort of some of the media coverage that has been focused on Strathcona Park, is there anything that you feel like this coverage has typically gotten wrong about the situation? And do you have any, I guess, sort of suggestions on what you would rather see being discussed when talking about Strathcona Park and the tent city?
We talk about focusing on when people are talking about homelessness and housing, looking at the most vulnerable, not the most visible. And so it's something that's got a lot of visibility and a lot of attention, a lot of media attention. And so anything that happens is, you know, just this really massive amount of attention. And I think it does breed the vigilantism. It does breed the ongoing stigma. It does breed more misreporting, or maybe more people wanting to step forward to say that's something happen that may or may not have happened or may or may not be related to the park. I think the media does have an accountability here, and to look at, if you're looking at homelessness or housing issues or the homelessness crisis, to look at the breadth of the problem and the whole issue and how it's throughout the city and throughout so many areas. And, you know, it's in the West End and it's in downtown and it's everywhere. It's not just the one place where people actually are finding some support. And, you know, you don't usually hear about all the infrastructure that we talked about and all that massive level of community support and structure. And when people come to the camp, they're actually provided with tents and bedding and food and nursing and bottled water and health and wellness and all of those things. And outreach workers, you know, you hear that outreach workers are not able to access the camp, but in fact there's like ongoing constant support from outreach workers and support workers. I think just that media accountability and transparency, and to look at the big picture if we're talking about homelessness and the housing crisis, to look at it everywhere and not just within the tent city where there actually is some support that's happening and is some action that's happening, or talk sort of the stories of all the success stories, like the people who've, those few people who have been housed from the tent city or who are taking on roles, or the level of community support or all the positive things, the cultural support and programming that happens, and all of those more stories that are just not quite as dramatic, that are what we always see in the news, because stigma and the trauma are so kind of go hand in hand and are cyclical as well. And so addressing some of those and having a little bit more accountable reporting and understanding of homelessness would probably go a long ways to address some of that.
We've covered quite a bit of ground already, but is there anything just sort of wrapping up that you would like to add that we haven't discussed yet?
Just again, all the things that we've talked about, that there is that need for support to address going into cold weather. Those are sort of like the immediate needs. Always looking for the support for the funds that we have and the donation drives. So community support has been kind of the number one way that the camp is supported right now. And so thankful for that generosity and hoping for that. The just kind of like the accountability and understanding that there are so many perspectives and that there's really an undue targeting of what's happening within the camp, and really negative sort of understanding and perception. And so just being open to knowing that there's different perspectives, that things happen in lots of places. It doesn't mean that it's not heartbreaking and it's not really hard and challenging and all of those things, but that it's not just about sort of like targeting or scrutinizing one group of people. There's so few places that people can access right now, and you know, the parking ban, the RV parking ban is one more way that people, that's going to produce homelessness. So contacting city and park board and provincial officials to talk about the access to public spaces and not enforcing parking bans and not furthering that cycle of homelessness.
Okay, amazing. Great. Thank you so much for your time, Fiona.
Thank you for having me on.
When you purchase the latest TV, tablet, or smartphone, don't forget to do the right thing with your old ones. Recycle them. The Consumer Electronics Association and its members are making recycling your old devices as easy as buying new ones. Just go to greenergadgets.org, type in your zip code, and you'll instantly find the recycling location closest to your home. You'll also find recycling tips, like asking the store where you buy your new TV if they'll haul away your old one. Don't let your old tech tools clog your local landfill. Just visit greenergadgets.org.
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
And we're back. You're listening to On The Point, CITR's weekly local news show. You just heard News Collective reporter Maddie Delplay and chat with Fiona York about the tent city at Strathcona Park.
Up next, we'll be talking with Greg Mansfield, a horror author based here in Vancouver. Since 2007, Greg has been running a website called Ghosts of Vancouver that keeps track of which buildings in Vancouver are haunted by ghosts, apparitions, entities, and all other sorts of paranormal phenomena.
Greg's even released a book, also called Ghosts of Vancouver, that expands upon many of the ghost stories he's come across. He's also a part-time member of the ghost hunting group Cold Spotters, and has assisted them on many of their investigations.
So I think it's fair to say he believes in ghosts?
Oh yeah, he does. And he says that he's communicated with one as well. So yeah, let's listen to what he had to say. So I guess to start, can you tell our listeners just a little bit about who you are and what kind of research you do looking into the ghosts of Vancouver?
Sure. Well, I'm Greg Mansfield. By day, I'm an education department manager for a nonprofit. So I've been into adult education for, over 25 years. And I've been interested in the paranormal, primarily ghosts, since I was a kid. You know, it's around Halloween time, you know, you'd go to the school library in elementary school. And in those days, the teacher would bring out the Charlie Brown Halloween books and so on. And I was kind of bored by that even as an 8-year-old, you know, and one day I said to the librarian, you know, are ghosts real? And she said, well, it's funny you should ask me that. There are some people who believe that they are real, and there are some books here that you may be interested in. And she showed me some of these classic books by these really old authors like Peter Underwood and Hans Holzer and, you know, people who have since passed away, but wrote classic books in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And I started reading these, and, you know, the ones I read were geared to younger kids, but I was fascinated. I thought, wow, this could really be a thing, that there are ghosts, and what are they? And maybe they're the actual sort of proof that we live or carry on after death. So, you know, it ties into that big mystery, right?
So what kind of like research do you do looking into like Vancouver's ghosts?
Yeah, I've done two kinds of research. You know, there's either just going online or at the Vancouver Library and looking at old newspaper clippings. Also, you know, blog stories. But, you know, I started this, over 10 years ago. So there wasn't a lot going on the internet. And so I thought, well, you know, I'll be lucky if I find maybe 10 or a dozen stories. Well, I'm now up to 39 and counting. You know, I've got others that I still need to write about. So there's that. There's the actual research part. And then there's also, you know, going to places or talking to people on the phone or in person who have had experience at various places around town.
So figured we may as well get right into it. What would you say are some of the most notable haunted places in Vancouver?
Okay. For a long time, I've been talking about the Waterfront Station as being Vancouver's most haunted. And it definitely is. It has lots of interesting stories. Of encounters there, security guards, people who work there, and so on. But more recently, what's really caught my attention is St. Paul's Hospital. It has three buildings in the complex, and two of those buildings are really old. They go back to the turn of the 20th century, from the 1800s to 1900s. Turn of the century buildings, they're all brick buildings, and they're really big. And when you go inside, the really long hallways and lots of rooms and so on. And I had the pleasure and the privilege of getting a tour by somebody who works at the hospital. And I can't say who because they want to remain anonymous. But we had a tour back in the summer with this person. And we were shown inside. I say we because I belong to a group of investigators called Cold Spotters as well. We were shown inside and the stories are mind-blowing. There is so much there. Security guards there and people who work there, you know, overnight shifts or graveyard shifts, pardon the pun, have all kinds of experiences with footsteps, seeing shadows, hearing voices being yelled down the hallways, seeing apparitions. It just goes on and on and on. Another one that recently we've been doing a lot of investigation work at is at a haunted mansion in North Burnaby.
Oh.
And yes, it came to my attention a few years ago, and I won't say the name because let's leave it for the book. It's in the book. You'll know it when you see it if you read the chapter. And it's a fascinating place. It was built in 1905 by a fellow that worked for a major grocery importing business here in Vancouver at the time. He made a ton of money. And it's a very large house, and over time it was sold and became a girls' school, a Catholic girls' school. And it has a very sort of inviting atmosphere, but it's still spooky at the same time when you go in. And they film TV shows and movies there. One of the TV series that used it a lot was Supernatural. Isn't that appropriate, right? And there are a couple of ghosts in there that we've encountered on our investigations. One is of a man who is believed to have lived in the house when it, for a short period, it was a tuberculosis hospital, and he's heard speaking and coughing and slamming doors. And the other ghost that we literally had interaction with about 6 weeks ago during an investigation, ghost of a little girl who has been seen running around the house, and she giggles if you see her, and she runs away, and then you try and find her, and she's gone. She's just disappeared. She also recently freaked out somebody working in the house by walking near that person and then walking straight through a wall. And that person was so freaked out that she left the building and refused to ever work in there again. And we talked to this little girl, literally. I mean, I'm not kidding you. We had what we call an EVP session where we call out and we look for voice recordings. And we asked the little girl to sing the alphabet song with us, and she actually did. Here, just faintly, saying a letter. And then when we asked her how old she was, you could just barely hear her say that she was 5, which was fascinating. And it was really good evidence for us anyway. It was a moment where you go, yeah, you know, this stuff is real and this is actually happening.
And yeah, I was reading through your website, kind of looking at all the locations that were listed as kind of haunted in Vancouver. And I saw that you listed Waterfront Station as the most haunted location in downtown Vancouver. Can you tell me a little bit about the hauntings that are going on there?
Yeah, there's a ton of different ghosts, and some are what we would call residuals. That is, they don't seem to be intelligent entities. They go through a cycle of action that you can, if you're lucky enough to witness, but they're always doing something the same every time. And the ghost there that would be like that is of a woman in a flapper dress, you know, from the 1930s, who's been seen in an upper hallway by security guards, who is seen dancing as if to music. And then when the security guard approaches, she disappears. And every time she's seen doing the same dance, but she doesn't interact. And you think, well, why is there a woman in an old style dress from the 30s dancing there? Well, you have to realize that in those days, the station was not only a train station, but there were ballrooms upstairs, places to stay. It was kind of like Vancouver Airport, you know, that has the hotel in it and restaurants and places to meet and so on. And it was very similar. So this is why that lady's seen there, we think. But why you see the same thing going on and on? It's like a slip in time. And then there's intelligent ghosts, entities that are at Waterfront as well. And one security guard one night was patrolling a room upstairs that was disused. And he went in, it was pitch black. He didn't turn the lights on, but he has flashlight. And he was just looking around the room, making sure there's nobody there. And then this figure he caught in his flashlight of this older woman who looked very gaunt and very pale, rushed towards him with a horrible look on her face as if she was about to attack him. And he was frightened to death. He ran out of the room, and he was so traumatized that he had to take time off work. And he actually painted a painting of this woman. I've never seen it. It's apparently stashed somewhere. But he was so shocked. He wanted to show everybody what this horrible woman looked like. That freaked him out. So she was a ghost. Also, I've talked about in the book about swim recruiting. A friend of mine is president and founder of that company. They have their office on the third floor of Waterfront Station. Beautiful view of the harbor and so on. And some staff members there have had some interesting occurrences in the office, either early in the morning or late at night. One of the favorite stories is of a young worker there who was coming into the office about four summers ago. And she lived fairly close to Waterfront Station in Gastown. She jogged to work. And so she had an appointment with a customer at 8:30. So she thought, well, I'll go in early and I'll get changed and I'll get ready for this meeting. So she got there and she was just about to change into her work clothes when there was this pounding on a side door from one of the hallways. And she thought, that's strange. And it kind of freaked her out a little bit because it was such a hard pound on the door that she called out and she is, who's there? You know, who's bothering me kind of thing. And the pounding stopped. And then she thought, this is really weird. So she went to the front reception area of this office and she looked through the glass, you know, windows at the side of the main entrance and couldn't see anybody, couldn't see anything. And she thought, oh, well. And so she went, got changed, and then settled down at her desk and was just booting up her computer when the pounding on the door happened again and rattling of the handle, of the door handle. And this really was just freaking her out. Who would this be? Why are they so insistent? And so she got up the courage to walk over to the door when it was still being pounded on. And she opened the door to say to this person, would you, you know, give it up kind of thing. There was obviously nobody there.
Wow.
She looked down the hallway. There was a set of fire stairs down the way, not too far. She couldn't see anybody. She couldn't hear anybody running away or anything, as if they were playing a prank on her. Then about 2 weeks later, she was standing in the same hallway with a colleague going for lunch. They're waiting for an elevator to come. And they felt this cold spot. You know, this is what happens when a ghost is nearby. They think they drain energy from you and or the air around you. They felt this cold, and her colleague felt this hand brush down the back of her neck. And she screamed because, you know, there's nobody there. So something is going on near swim recruiting in that hallway. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, lots more stories. There's tons of ghosts that roam around there. And that's just a small selection, some of the best stories.
And another one I wanted to ask about, it kind of seems like the Gastown area is particularly, there's a lot of ghosts around there. And
yeah,
you had pointed out on your website that the old spaghetti factory, people are really interested in the ghost stories there. Can you tell me a bit about what's going on there?
Yeah, what's going on there is, it is actually, I get the most hits on the website for the old spaghetti factory and for the Hotel Vancouver. Those are the two most popular that most people have heard of and are interested in. What I've discovered about the spaghetti factory is it is actively haunted. We don't know why. There is the famous ghost of the trolley conductor who has been seen in the old BC Electric trolley car that is in the restaurant and has been repurposed for dining tables inside, right? It's a really cool artifact. And so most people talk about the ghost of the conductor that's been seen in there. He hasn't made an appearance for quite some time, though. So the reports of him go back a while. I'm thinking to the, you know, 90s and early 2000s, but you don't hear much about him anymore. What we do hear a lot about is the young boy that haunts the restaurant. He's been seen more recently, many, many times. And he's a mischievous little guy. A psychic once went in there, and if you believe in psychic mediums, you know, some people I think are gifted, but there's a lot of fakes out there. But I'm told that this one woman who was genuine went in, and she picked up on the name Edward, that this little boy is about 6 years old. His name is Edward. And when he's seen in, you know, little boys were dressed up in the 30s and 40s, very smartly, right? And even earlier, maybe the 1920s. They would normally have a little tweed jacket and shorts and a flat cap, right? And this is exactly how this little boy is seen, what he's wearing. And he runs around the restaurant and he likes to do funny things. So he's been blamed for piling chairs up on tables. When, you know, a server is turned around in a closed section of the restaurant and she'll hear this noise, she'll turn around and there's all these chairs stacked on the table. How did that happen? or cutlery will be all thrown into a pile when just minutes before it was all nicely arranged on the table. Most interestingly, and a freaky story, is that this little boy was seen late one night, and that has been seen twice late one night by two separate servers. So the restaurant closes at 11, I believe. And between 11 and midnight, whatever servers are working late with the manager will set the tables in the back section and the front section for the next day. So they're all ready to be used. And so one occasion about 4 or 5 years ago, a young gal was working late with the manager, Chris, at the time. She had been setting tables in the midsection. So if you know the Spaghetti Factory, you got a front section where the trolley is, a midsection in the very back section, which isn't used as much. In the midsection, setting tables, and out the corner of her eye, she saw this little boy run past her. And she thought, that's weird. The restaurant closed. All the customers should be gone. What's this little kid doing here? So she followed him, or chased him, into the back section of the restaurant and saw him duck under a table. And so she went over to the table, kind of moved a chair, and there he was on all fours looking up at her. But the freaky thing was, he had black spaces where his eyes should be.
Oh my God.
He screamed, ran from the back section, ran up to the front where Chris, the manager, was, told him what had happened. And she said, I can't work here. I'm sorry. I quit. And he never came back. And then to corroborate this, a couple of years later, I've told by the newer manager that's there today that a similar occurrence happened, where another young gal whose server in the restaurant was again setting tables in the midsection, and this little boy ran past her. She saw him clearly in the flat cap, the tweed jacket, the shorts, and she thought, huh? Should be no kids here. It's too late. Restaurant's closed. Again, followed him into the back. He had disappeared. Nowhere to be seen. So she went to the front and told the manager what had experienced. Now, she didn't quit. She didn't have as traumatic a sighting as the previous one did. But there's this little boy there, and he's also been seen running around. There's columns in the restaurant when you go in. There's the greeting area. There's columns. He's been seen with his arm around a column, swinging around. You look again, and he's gone. So this, we don't know, this little kid, we don't know why he's there, but he's definitely, these days, the most active ghost.
So, like, through all this research, have you ever had any personal experiences with any of these haunted locations? Or, in other words...
Yeah, the one I just mentioned, the haunted mansion in North Burnaby, was one of the best. You know, that story about how we were literally conversing with this ghost of a little girl. You know, that's the kind of thing you look for or listen for and hope for, and you don't often get. You know, ghost investigating is like going fishing in a lake that you've never fished before. You don't know what bait to use. You don't know if you're going to get any nibbles or anything. You could come home every day for, you know, a whole week's vacation fishing with nothing to show for it, right? And that's a lot like ghost investigating. So when you throw the questions out there and you've got your audio recorder in your hand and you're literally hearing something coming back at you and you know it's none of your colleagues, there's no other explanation for it, that is a brilliant moment. And also, you know, we've heard door slamming, footsteps there, bangs that we can't explain, and all kinds of things. So those are my personal experiences. My big regret so far, though, is I have never seen an apparition. It's relatively rare. If you do, you're either terrified or you feel fortunate. For those of us who are crazy enough to do this research and investigations, for us, it's brilliant. It's amazing when you get to see it, but it's so rare.
And after all this research, do you believe in ghosts?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I say to people who ask me that, without a doubt. People might think that's nuts, or they think, well, what's the point? And I get that. There's a big skeptic in me too. I don't believe every story I hear. I want to know more, and I want to make sure the witness was reliable. A lot of people like to tell tall tales, right? But yes, personally, I do. I have family members who've seen them and had encounters. I've had my own little experiences, obviously, that have really helped. Yes, I believe there's something going on. What it is, we're not quite sure. We think because we're able to interact with certain of these things that it is possibly a objective proof, not objective, but subjective proof for those of us who have had experiences that there is potentially life after death. And I couch it very carefully, right? Because I don't want to come across as this crackpot who says, oh, it's definitely proof. Oh, yes, you must believe me. No, I don't go that far. I'm not an evangelist. I'm just fascinated.
And that's all I got. Yeah. Thank you so much for all this. This has gone really well, and I really appreciate it.
Oh, pleasure, Joshua. Thank you for reaching out. It's great to meet you and to do this with you. It's been fun.
Hi, this is Sam from the Go Team, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hey, are you interested in radio? Passionate about gender issues? Want to be an active part of your community? Then join the wave and become part of CITR's Gender Empowerment Collective. We meet every Friday at 2 p.m. and we want your voice. We are all about empowering everyone and giving you the chance to speak your mind. No experience necessary. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, or email us at genderempowerment@citr.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Point, CITR's weekly news show bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from the Lower Mainland.
Let's talk about Halloween tomorrow. Obviously, there won't be any parties because Dr. Bonnie Henry said no, saving us from the inevitable flood of sexy virus costumes. One thing we won't be saved from, though, is fireworks. Tomorrow is the last official Halloween you can set off fireworks because the city's banned fireworks after November the 1st. As of that day, the sale and use of consumer fireworks will no longer be permitted in the city and may only be discharged by a certified technician. That certified technician must hold both a federal operator certificate and a municipal fire permit. Firecrackers and bottle rockets have already been banned, so there's no need to include them in the ban. And the latest you can buy fireworks is 6 p.m. on October the 31st, which is tomorrow. Tomorrow. And the fine for violating the new rules is $1,000. So, fireworks. A firework ban. Is this effective at all?
I don't think so, because... So, two things. One, it's like... You can still buy fireworks from, like, places which don't have the bylaws affected to them. So, like, you can still go to Burnaby or the Musqueam Indian Band or, like, any of these places and just buy the fireworks and just set them off. So, like... You know, it won't really matter too much, I don't think. Like, if you really want to see some pretty lights, you can do that. Although, I don't really see the point, because you can just watch a video. Like, I really don't see the point. But, you know, anyway, that's just me. But, like, yeah, so it's only for the city of Vancouver, which is only 25% of the Lower Mainland. So, like, I don't think it's going to do too much, but I guess it's a good thing.
Yeah, I feel like intentions are good. I just feel like, and people have mentioned this as being a concern, like, how are they going to enforce that? And just, like, also maybe it'll just go, like, the sale will just go underground now, and that's even harder to kind of restrict and regulate.
I'm going to be on the record as being very anti-firework. I think they're annoying, dangerous, and they scare pets. And I remember walking through downtown Vancouver, I think it was Dunbar, a couple of years ago, and it just sounded like, boom, 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 like when I was just walking through the street, and I was just like, okay, this is ridiculous. So yeah, I don't know, I'm sympathetic to the ban.
I actually also, like, yeah. Fireworks, though. Maybe I'm just, like, awful, and, like, I can definitely sympathize with, like, veterans or like people who have PTSD and like all of that. Like, I definitely sympathize with that. But I also, like, as an individual, I enjoy fireworks, you know? It's fun.
We all like to blow things up sometimes.
Yeah. So I don't know.
But even like things like the celebration of light and just like the big fireworks shows that would happen over the summer times. You see one big fireworks show, you've seen them all.
No, I mean, not to be like pretentious, but no, there's a difference. You know, I'm the type of person who will go to like fireworks shows and I like just compare them. And I do think, you know, certain countries put out different quality fireworks, which is an entirely different conversation. Mm-hmm. But I like it.
I mean, like I am an Indian person, so like I'm used to Diwali, which is like the festival of lights where people go absolutely insane with this stuff. So like I am sort of conditioned to hate fireworks. I can see that sort of, I mean, you know, it's a nice like communal experience to like, I can see that argument, but like if it's, I don't know, like I support the outright ban 100%, but I feel like at some point in the near future, it might get pushed back. Who knows? Like this might prove unpopular with some people. I don't know. I don't think it's too much of an issue, but you know, it's whatever.
I know that a lot of other municipalities in Metro Vancouver have banned them. I can't remember off the top of my head because I just remember reading about this a long time ago. I think when the motion for this thing was first put forward. But yeah, so it's not like this is unprecedented. It's just kind of the biggest city that's doing it.
Yeah, it's been illegal since like 2005 in Surrey, so.
Yeah, regulation is good for sure. The question is if this ban will actually like help or make things worse. But I definitely like agree in like regulating fireworks for sure. Coolio. So speaking about scary things, let's talk about the provincial election. Obviously, the NDP rode the polls straight to comfortable victory, and the Liberals had some huge losses. Notably, Jane Thornwaite lost her election in North Vancouver Seymour, and Jess Johal lost in Richmond Queensborough. Let's talk about it.
And you know, Jane Thornwaite, I think she was almost comfortable in that seat until the whole Bowen Moss scandal erupted. And she lost, well, not comfortably, but she did lose, you know, like it wasn't a close thing like Michael Lee's riding is right now. Like, we won't know what's happening to Michael Lee in Vancouver Langara until November 16th, which is when all the mail-in votes get counted. Like, it wasn't close. Like, she lost badly, which is quite funny, I think. And it just shows how bad of a, like, the leaking ship the BC Liberals really were this time around.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was also a recent CBC article piece about former and maybe even some current, but I think it was mostly just former BC Liberals going like, no, here's why we lost, here's the problem. And it was mostly around like, I think diversity and I think the social conservatism or like pandering to social conservatives partially.
Interesting is that there was an article in The Breaker today, that it was like Andrew Wilkinson had a Zoom call with a bunch of BC Liberals that I guess got leaked to The Breaker, who wrote an article about it. And it talked about how Wilkinson was basically saying, yeah, no, we ran a great campaign. You have nothing to apologize for. This was just, you know, incumbent's advantage during the pandemic. And it kind of made me think like, you know, so many people have offered a lot of critiques about their campaign during like kind of in the fallout of this. So it's like, is it really incumbent's advantage?
I mean, he could say what he likes, but like almost all of the policy proposals by the Liberals were like whiff after whiff. Like the PST thing went down really badly. The ICBC thing really went down really badly. Like nothing seemed to strike a chord. And considering as soon as John Hogan called the election, all of the talk was around him and how sort of unwise of a decision this was. It wasn't like there wasn't ground for the BC Liberals to strike. You know, the iron was hot, but you know, they did not take that opportunity at all. So like, I don't know what, maybe he's just trying to say that to like not already beat up on his really beat up party, but I wouldn't have said that.
Such a good campaign that they ran, even though they lost, yet for some reason he's resigning.
Something I find interesting is when candidates of a party go like, I'm with the BC Liberals, but I don't agree with this, this, and this. And it's like, you joined this party, you know what like the party stance is and all of these things. You can't really just like have your cake and eat it too or something. Like, I don't know, it's interesting that you think you can separate the two, because a lot of people are like, oh, like I'm financially conservative, but not socially conservative. And I don't know, what do you guys think?
That's such a fallacy. Like, if you're socially progressive or whatever, but you refuse to support the financial policies that would support the marginalized, then you're not socially progressive.
I think that also raises a very good point where it's like, yeah, I'm with the BC Liberals, but I don't agree with, or not even with BC Liberals. Yeah, I'm with Party A, but I don't agree with their platform on these specific points. It's like, well, okay, cool. So what are you going to do? You're going to wait for the convention to come around, put forward a motion to change that platform? Because we know how the system works. You cannot, unless you are explicitly given the permission to vote your conscience and your beliefs, you're voting with the party. So you chose to join that party because you even if you don't agree with everything, you're going to vote for everything. If an NDPer, like a BC NDPer right now, if they put like UNDRIP legislation and a BC NDP member voted against it, they're going to get a thrashing from their party because you're not supposed to vote against it. Even if you disagree with it, you're in that party. You were given the funds for a campaign. You were given all this, like, basically name recognition by association. And if you go against them, of course they're going to be like, all right, well, we didn't care if you disagreed with it. You were going to vote with us because we gave you this seat. But you voted against us, so guess what? You're out of the caucus, or you're suspended from the caucus. It's such a dumb position to be in where you're like, yeah, but I don't agree with this. Unless you actually stand up in the legislature and actively vote against something, or also, like, during the conventions, you're saying, no, we should change this policy because it's dumb, then I don't care if you don't agree with it. You're with that party. You chose to be with that party. So if you don't agree with it, don't be with that party.
Yeah, and something that, as we were talking about, big tent parties where, like, everything goes and you can believe whatever you want, but, you know, you can fly under our banner, and how well that worked out for the BC Liberals. So much of that is sort of dictated by the leader, right? And that's something we often forget, because Andrew Wilkinson, he stuck by Laurie Thrones until the end almost, right? He stuck by so many of his really failing candidates until the end. And he did in fact lose very badly. So on the topic, I want to talk about the NDP, because obviously John Horgan led them to a really comfortable victory, and he was analogous to Bonnie Henry, maybe using her, he sort of rode the wave. He was like the star for the NDP, really, in many ways. He is going to form a cabinet. If it resembles the last cabinet, I don't think there's going to be any meaningful sort of change in terms of policy. But if a wave of NDPers did get elected, and some of them are quite young. Aman Singh is the first turban-wearing British Columbian to ever be elected to the legislature. So maybe there might be some interesting cabinet appointments. We know for sure that Adrian Dix is going to be Minister of Health again, because he's been confirmed to appear alongside Bonnie Henry. So that much we know. But everything else is not really up in the air, but it might be. And I don't know if the cabinet's going to change significantly, but if it does, that might mean a change in status quo, but who knows?
Yeah, the hope is too, when he's forming this cabinet, he doesn't just say, I mean, we got, you know, our members is very diverse. I think we're fine with that. We just want people with experience in the ministry. The hope is they don't do that, but I'm not going to hold my breath, because that is very, very common.
Personally, I'm interested to see who becomes the finance minister, because Carol James isn't going to be there anymore. And so, you know, big position could be taken up by someone new.
Yeah.
Also, I'm calling it now. Oh, go on.
No, hard tech first.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm calling it now. Bowen Ma is going to be transportation minister. Definitely calling it.
I'll second that call. Yeah, let's see it. Let's see it happen. Come on.
Yeah. She tweets about public transit all the time. It's definitely going to happen.
Yeah, and I mean, on that topic, right, there's a Thai article just dropped an hour ago or so, which it's, we talked to Dr. Melanie Thomas about this, but like, you know, it isn't as much as the NDP won pretty easily. You know, BIPOC make up almost 37% of 36%, I should say, of the provincial population writ large, and less than 22% of the legislature is BIPOC now. And indigenous people, only, you know, 3% of MLAs, no black people in the legislature. I don't know if they're going to be represented in cabinet even, because, you know, that low of a percentage, you're really not working with too much. But let's see what happens. You know, still a lot of time for John Hogg to make these decisions, but I don't know. I don't know what the future holds. I know that certainly in terms of our near future, we know that we're all going to be stuck inside because COVID-19 numbers are not looking good. You know, that's the scariest thing that has happened over the past week. And that's the provincial election in British Columbia.
And also the increase in cases of COVID. It's kind of scary.
So that's our show. Thank you so much for listening. This has been On the Point by CITR News. We're here every Friday at 10 a.m. bringing you local news, and stay tuned for more amazing programming. If you have a